Dory only mentioned the presence of Original Guy and Huma, who was hard to miss, floating through our slovenly newsroom like an exotic bird in a red wool coat. They didn't know the half of it. Everyone huddled into the narrow entryway under the bureau's fluorescent lights. The guys forced themselves to offer me their usual clipped hello, which always reminded me of Seinfeld opening the door for Newman. Hello, Amy. After some handshakes, Carolyn led everyone down the drab, carpeted stairway to the conference room where the guys helped themselves to coffee, only to find that it had been left over from a previous meeting. The brown liquid was dank and acidic, and the creamer crumpled as it splashed into their styrofoam cups. We hadn't planned it that way, but serving stale coffee and day-old Danish to DC's most powerful people did send an effective message that things probably wouldn't go their way. I can't get into the details. I can only say that they griped about stories I thought were positive, like the one about Bill building a charitable legacy in Africa. They hated the timing. They complained about stories I thought were neutral, like Hillary working to rebuild bonds with black voters. Black people never left the Clintons, they said. They understandably despised a story about a Ukrainian oligarch, Viktor Pinchuk, who'd given millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation and had a slew of meetings with State Department officials. Viktor liked the story. He invited me to his annual conference, typically held in Yalta, the Tsar's fabled Black Sea resort town. I declined. But mostly they hated that the beat existed at all. They said Hillary was a private citizen. The story that put me on the radar as the Times Hillary Chronicler and made the proverbial target on my back more like a permanent tattoo arrived in a January 2014 issue of the New York Times Magazine, along with a doughy Hillary Moon face floating amid intergalactic dysfunction on its cover. I'd meant for my Planet Hillary story to serve as a 5,700-word primer about all the people the Clintons had collected over the years and the organizational mishigas that already threatened once again to entangle Hillary as she prepared for 2016. In an accompanying chart, I categorized the Clintons' minions, and almost all of my would-be sources, into competing solar systems. There was the inner circle, the 2008 victims, the people who do all the work, loyal henchmen, frenemies, posers, and so forth. Not surprisingly, almost everyone hated their designated place in the universe. Doug Band called to complain that he'd been positioned in the category the white boys next to the floating head of the irascible wonk and former White House policy advisor Ira Magaziner. I can't believe you put me next to that asshole. You know I hate that guy. One of the posers yelled at my editor that the placement could have cost him his gig as a paid Fox News contributor. Another offered to get Bill Clinton on the phone to tell us that he wasn't a poser, to which my editor replied, "That's exactly what a poser would do." A New York executive told me the poser label had been the worst thing ever to happen to me. He lived a charmed life. Worse, I'd been somewhat of a puppet in all of this, later learning that all the poor schmucks who ended up designated as posers had at some point pissed off the guys who'd accordingly steered me towards tagging them with that label. One of them, a friend and donor, was also the ex-husband of the buxom blonde whom one of the guys had an affair with on an earlier foundation trip to Africa. I'd started to get used to the idea of breaking some eggs to make an omelet, but with the Planet Hillary story, I'd dropped the whole damn carton. Carolyn always had her reporters' backs. I knew that after the D.C. meeting, she'd plop down on the sofa in her office next to the ping-pong table and tell me to never doubt my coverage. She'd remind me that we should have a combative relationship with the people we cover, and she'd say that I deserved combat pay. But during the meeting, Carolyn didn't say much. She disarmed the group, the way she disarmed reporters who came into her office unprepared. She took exaggerated sips of Diet Coke and squinted as they spoke, sometimes jutting her head toward our visitors and then leftward to me, giving the impression that she was listening to crazy talk and craved simultaneous translation. I kept trying to fill the silences. I apologized. I said I'd try to do a better job next time and I'd be more careful moving forward, but that just pissed the guys off more, the shrinking violet act and all. They seemed trapped in a time warp. Whitewater was yesterday, but all the positive stories and endorsements the Times had given Hillary in recent years were worthless relics. I could have tried to defend myself, but I was up against seven much smarter professional Hillary defenders, including Cheryl, a former deputy White House counsel. I didn't stand a chance. I kept thinking of the scene from Full Metal Jacket when Matthew Modine's private joker says, "Sir, the private believes that any answer he gives will be wrong, and the senior drill instructor will only beat him harder if he reverses himself, sir." My train back to New York after the meeting was delayed for hours. I crouched on the floor of Union Station between a Jamba Juice and Auntie Anne's pretzels to charge my iPhone and check my messages. The guys had dumped me. Their email might as well have read, "It's not you, it's me." Or they could have used the same line the Colombian waiter I went on a couple dates with in my 20s did when he texted me, "You are too high maintenance." From then on, I was to deal directly with Cheryl. Though she outranked the guys, this didn't feel like a reward. My job required me to have some semblance of a relationship with Hillary's press aides. There wasn't even a campaign yet, and I'd already failed. As it turned out, my interlude with Cheryl lasted a couple weeks until she got sick of me too and kicked me back to the guys. Only this time, instead of the OG, I was to deal with his less experienced but more presentable protege, the brown loafers wearer. Months later, when OG presented his mini-me to the rest of the political universe, everyone thought of him as the nice one. They'd gush, "Have you met him yet? He's such a nice guy." And at first, Brown Loafer's guy was a breath of fresh-faced air. He burst with optimism about Hillary's future and his own. He had OG's biting wit and a full suite of adorable facial expressions that played well on cable TV. He had a direct line to Hillary, who adored his adorableness, and none of OG's dark edge, sexist undertones, or tendency toward high drama. The guys got help from outside supporters. A ragtag group called HRC Super Volunteers sent me a warning. "We will be watching, reading, listening, and protesting coded sexism." According to their list, sexist language included polarizing, insincere, inevitable, and secretive, will do anything to win, represents the past, out of touch. David Carr always had my back. Like the blunt conscience of the times, David proved the only person who could really defend me. HRC's minions throw brushback pitch at NYT. "Look for NYT to lean in and hit one hard up the middle," he tweeted after the news of the DC confrontation leaked. He'd tell me again and again, "It's not you, it's them. You never made a single enemy on the media beat," he'd say. Sometimes when I needed an extra confidence boost, he'd email me one of his David emails. "There is no one else like you," he wrote. "Doubt yourself as a writer if you need to. It will drive you to new ways of thinking, but don't doubt that. You are your own damn thing." Despite writing a weekly column, mentoring Lena Dunham, and helping out on every breaking news story he could get his tarry hands on, David still made time to bestow emails like that and corresponding spirit animals on a small army of younger journalists. Around the same time, the guys took smug satisfaction in the Times' abrupt firing of Jill Abramson, a development that had nothing to do with Hillary coverage and that left me, like many young women in the newsroom, floored and sad. David would swing by my cubicle, a scarf wrapped in a Parisian knot around his pencil-thin neck, crumbs from his morning donut stuck in the crevices. He wouldn't say anything. He'd just make a claw motion with his hand and growl, a reminder that I was the polar bear. But polar bears are also lonely and endangered. I was floating on my own little iceberg, and it was melting fast. My interactions with Hillary over the course of 2014 continued to be few and far between, usually chance encounters when she'd always pretend to be thrilled to see me. In the spring, Bobby and I went to the premiere of a documentary film that Chelsea had executive produced about the unlikely friendship between an imam and a rabbi. It wasn't exactly the red carpet event of the century, and I turned out to be one of the only reporters there. Halfway through the cocktail party, Hillary walked in and made a beeline for the bar. Chelsea had announced earlier that day that she and her husband, Mark Mazinski, were expecting their first child. I no longer saw myself in Chelsea. She had grown into her celebrity with flowing straight hair and a permanent strawberry glow. Chelsea told Elle magazine that in her early 20s, her curls just naturally subsided, an affront to frizzy-haired women everywhere. I also happened to know her New York hairdresser and a keratin job when I saw it. Chelsea's press aide told me they'd studied how Britain's royal family had handled Princess Kate's pregnancy to devise the media strategy. "Congratulations, such wonderful news. How excited are you to be a grandma?" I said, sidling up to Hillary at the bar. I put my hand on her shoulder and felt the luscious satin of her chartreuse tunic beneath my palm. Hillary took a sip of Pinot Grigio and, as she swallowed, said, "Oh, Amy, it's just the absolute best." We walked into the crowd. "Secretary, I'd like you to meet my husband, Bobby," I said. Bobby, the oldest son of Irish schoolteachers, is from County Meath, a sweep of fluorescent green farmland on the River Boyne. The Trim Castle, a grand Norman structure used as the backdrop in the movie Braveheart, stands blocks from his family's red brick house. Like many Irish, he has a special place in his heart for the Clintons and their commitment to the peace process. He has hazy childhood memories of the British Army shoving their guns into his parents' Datsun Bluebird when his parents would drive across the border to Belfast. I picked up early on that the best way to get on my mother-in-law's good side was to declare something Irish superior to its English equivalent. "The brown bread just tastes better in Ireland," or, "Why can't an English breakfast come with black and white pudding?" I learned the Irish word for Christmas sweater, Ganzinolig. Bobby had hardly said hello when Hillary interrupted. "Is that an Irish accent I detect?" she said. They tucked into a corner out of my earshot and talked for 10 minutes about the Good Friday Agreement, their mutual concern that the crash of the Celtic Tiger could reignite the Troubles. I stood there making small talk with Mark Mazinski, watching Hillary and Bobby out of the corner of my eye. They ended up talking for longer than I'd talked to Hillary in months. Years? I wanted to crash, but I didn't. For all the times Hillary had inadvertently interfered in our relationship, leaving them alone to chat was the least I could do. In the taxi back to the East Village, Bobby sank down into the seat and propped his knees against the back of the Crown Vic. He isn't a talker. I usually blab and he listens and then inserts wisdom and witticisms. But that night in the taxi, he went on and on about meeting Hillary and their conversation with the elation of relaying the time he'd seen you two play at Slane Castle. I listened, happy to see him so happy, grateful for the reminder of that side of Hillary. A couple of months later, at a naturalization ceremony that included immigrants from 100 countries all waving American flags and mouthing the words to Lee Greenwood, Bobby was sworn in as an American citizen. Right after that, he registered to vote. I would try to see the 2016 election and Hillary, partly through Bobby's uncynical immigrant eyes. "For fuck's sake, she brought peace to Ireland. I don't care if she's funny on SNL," he'd say during the campaign. By the fall of 2014, I thought we'd turned a corner, or at least I'd learned how to handle the beat without raiding my mom's dwindling Xanax stash. There were actual events to cover. Hillary did the Harkin steak fry in Iowa. She campaigned for midterm Democrats. Hard Choices, her empty brick of a memoir about the State Department, came out. The fledgling Hillary traveling press corps trailed her to every dreary midterm rally, every Barnes & Noble and Costco book signing. We all went to Little Rock for the 10th anniversary of the opening of the Clinton Presidential Library, which drew the 1992 campaign alumni. "Hey, Hillary, Begala's still got his jacket," Bill yelled, pointing to Paul Begala in a denim Clinton Gore 92 jacket embroidered with a thrusting donkey. The weekend included an after-party at the mansion of the Clintons' Little Rock decorator, Khaki Hawkersmith, known in D.C. as Tacky Khaki, and featuring Kevin Spacey holding court at an outdoor bar doing his Bill Clinton impersonation. And there was a late night at the Capitol Hotel bar in Little Rock, where an inebriated Terry McAuliffe put his arm around me and said, "Amy, can you believe I'm governor?" No. Gene Sperling, Clinton's verbose economic advisor, cornered me until after 3 a.m. to defend the earned income tax credit. Sid Blumenthal stewed in a corner nursing a Moscow mule. Ready for Hillary, the group that called itself a grassroots super PAC, as if that weren't an oxymoron, held a donor confab at the Sheraton in Midtown. James Carville, Paul Begala, and other members of the original Clinton War Room held panel discussions on topics like "It's the economy, stupid," and "Lessons learned from 2008. They critiqued Hillary's 08 campaign, telling reporters that every 6 weeks there seemed to be a new slogan and there was nothing people could wrap their arms around. Harold Ickes, known in the White House as Bill Clinton's garbage man for reasons that had nothing to do with waste disposal, briefed donors from a third-floor conference room. He predicted a hard-fought 2016 general election battle in which Hillary would confront Jeb Bush, Rob Portman, a ticket bolstered by a simple message along the lines of, "It's time for a change." But the biggest pre-campaign schmooze fest was the Clinton Global Initiative, CGI, in New York in September, on my birthday to be exact. The Davos-like gathering that matches wealthy donors with worthy causes. Because this would be the last CGI before Hillary became a presidential candidate, the press shop had assigned handlers to escort reporters everywhere, lest we run into a donor who went off message. The theme that year was reimagining impact, not to be confused with 2013's mobilizing for impact or 2012's designing for impact. There was a lot of impact happening at CGI. I wrote a brief blog post about a young press minder, an intern I later learned, who had followed me into the restroom. When I asked one of the guys for comment, he sent me a press release about American Standards' Blush for Good campaign to improve sanitation for 3 million people in the developing world. "Since you're so interested in bathrooms and CGI," he said. It was worse than the Yorkie. It was worse than anything else I would publish for the next 3 years. I'd written the Potty Minder post as a brief, breezy CGI scene setter, not a serious commentary on relations between the Clintons and the media. But that's not how the wider world saw things. The Washington Post published a column, "The Clinton Team is Following Reporters to the Bathroom. Here's Why That Matters." The Free Beacon called for one of the guys, ironically the most decent and professional of the cohort, to stick his big obnoxious head in the toilet and flush for good. That didn't help matters. Until then, I hadn't fully grasped the impact of a Times story in the viral news era. Bathroomgate was discussed on the Today Show, CNN, MSNBC, NPR, and ad nauseum on Twitter. I declined every interview request. I just wanted it to go away. By the time Bill stepped off the stage after CGI's closing plenary session, called Aiming for the Moon and Beyond because he spoke via a satellite link to a couple NASA astronauts who appeared weightless on board the International Space Station, the only story out of CGI anyone was talking about was the bathroom incident. "God damn it, we're trying to save the world and all these people can talk about is the goddamn bathroom," was how one person summed up Bill's backstage reaction. Hillary's expletive-laced response was worse. She told the guy she'd held out hope I might still treat her fairly, but she'd given up on me after the bathroom post. To be very honest, this episode was upsetting to people, not least of which the foundation team, Brown Loafers, said. The guys told me the post and a subsequent selfie I'd tweeted with a different press minder had humiliated a young intern. I felt awful about the whole thing. I hadn't identified the intern and didn't know her name. I had a handwritten apology note, but the guys, who'd demanded I apologize, wouldn't tell me where to send it. I could handle another fight with the guys, but the last thing I wanted was for some hard-working kid to be inadvertently swept up in my media shitstorm. After that, the guys and I tried to avoid one another. They'd ask if I was working with any, preferably male, colleagues or researchers, and said they would gladly talk to them instead. Of all the guys, Outsider Guy, who a couple years back had fought to get me access and unleashed on a Ugandan military official who wouldn't allow me, a cockroach reporter, into a Clinton Foundation event, had become the most venomous. Maybe because he knew me the best ever since Iowa and the time we'd shadowed Bill and Chelsea shaking hands and stirring up mayhem in Las Vegas casinos ahead of the 2008 Nevada caucuses, Outsider Guy also knew how to wound me more permanently than the others. The things he said stuck with me as I morphed in his eyes and occasionally my own from ally to cockroach. On a story about Martin Scorsese killing an HBO documentary on Bill Clinton's life after Chelsea had allegedly requested a final cut, Outsider Guy would deal only with Michael Sipley, my co-author in Hollywood, and a grizzled industry veteran. "It's hard for me to believe you deal with them for a living," Sipley said, adding that his brief conversation with Outsider Guy had been the nastiest exchange of a career that included getting yelled at by Harvey Weinstein and several studio executives sniffing coke off conference tables. I tried to give the guys a taste of their own medicine. One night, at a cocktail party in the West Village townhouse of a former White House aide, a pile of Clinton hands, old and new, talked about the recent news that Robert Gibbs would leave his role as Obama's White House press secretary to be the top corporate flack at McDonald's. "You couldn't pay me enough," one of the guys said. "I'd rather work for Big Tobacco. Seems more honest," a White House aide turned Wall Street executive agreed. I was in a debate with the guys about a page one feature set for the weekend paper. I explained that this would be a heartfelt portrait of Hillary's mother, Dorothy Rodham, and how her childhood struggles would form the emotional core of her daughter's 2016 campaign. "Really? There's nothing else I should know," hired gun guy said. "You always find a way to include some kind of dig." "You're serious? You think I'm going to take a dig at her dead mother?" "I don't know," he said, lifting his shoulders a couple of inches and pushing his open-palmed hands out in a cartoonish shrug. "You know," I said, taking a sip of rosé and cutting him off, "best-case scenario, this all ends with a job at McDonald's." Chapter 10. Iowa, I'm back. Indianola, September 2014. "Secretary, can you believe you're back in Iowa? Hillary, does this mean you're running? Can you win here this time?" Hillary stood in front of a char griller, pretending to flip a steak at the Harkin Steak Fry in Iowa. It was the political event of the year for Democrats, Hillary's first trip back to the state that had wrecked her 2008 presidential campaign, and the clearest public sign yet that she would run. For decades, the Harkin Steak Fry was the mandatory testing ground for would-be Democratic candidates. I watched as she held the wooden handle of a spatula at a safe distance, as if a garden snake were coiled around the end. Then she gave the photographers a smile so open-mouthed and amplified that, looking back on it, I should have seen it as a cry for help. The entire Democratic establishment should have seen it. The image screamed all at once, "How long do I have to act like I enjoy this shit, and why the fuck am I back in this state, and dear God, what am I doing?" But what Hillary actually said to the press that afternoon was, "It's great! It's fabulous to be back! I love Iowa." I looked around the press scrum at the steak fry. We were all scrambling to write almost identical stories, using almost identical quotes and almost identical color. She smiled in front of hay bales, an American flag, and a John Deere tractor. The last time I'd been in Iowa with Hillary, I still felt like a foreign correspondent. Now, my journalism had become more like a feeding frenzy than a movable feast. I was no longer the kid who didn't know any better than to stand up and cheer at a town hall. I'd become omnivorous, driven beyond all rationale by byline count and Twitter mentions. I lived in fear of being scooped over even the most insignificant minutia. Politico may have beaten me on the Ready for Hillary fundraiser at the Standard Hotel in New York, but damn it, I heard the exclusive news that tickets cost $20.16 and that the signature cocktails included an $18 gin and lime concoction called the Ultimate Ceiling Breaker. We were so starved for tiny tidbits of news that I groveled with one of the guys to use the names of his cats, Uday and Husay, named after Saddam Hussein's sons because they were little terrorists, in the Planet Hillary story. I was starting to see things, even how Hillary flipped a steak, with cynicism, and I feared the coming campaign would engulf what was left of my wide-eyed 2008 self. At the steak fry, Iowa Hillary, the most belabored of all the versions of Hillary I'd mentally characterized, delivered an unintentionally ominous, "Hello, Iowa, I'm back." She cracked a joke about Bill's vegan diet. "It does really feel like just yesterday when I was last here at the Harkin Steak Fry, or as my husband now prefers to call it, the stir fry," drawing some giggles from the leery crowd of party faithful. She then embarked on 15 minutes of vanilla remarks. "In Washington, there's too little cooperation and too much conflict," she said, in what, even for Hillary, ranked high in the pantheon of pablum political talk. This was when Bernie Sanders was still an obscure socialist senator from Vermont, and Hillary's aides had urged her to take out any references to raising the minimum wage, advising that this might still be too hot and partisan and might prefer just saying we have a choice whether to move forward. Bill sat behind her, his mouth newly flopped open in a way that made people assume he was older and sicker than he actually was. He wore a red and white gingham print button-down shirt, a recent birthday present from Hillary.
"It kind of makes me feel like a tablecloth at a diner," he told us.
When Hillary finished, Tom Harkin took the podium, and in 9 folksy words stroked Bill's fragile ego and undermined Hillary in a scene that stayed with me for the rest of the campaign.
"We saved the best for last, didn't we, folks?" Harkin said. "Chants of Bill" echoed over the grassy field.
As both Clintons headed back to their SUV and accompanying 11-car motorcade, a handful of young Latino immigrants, whose numbers had swelled since 2008, shouted out to Hillary about whether she agreed with Obama's mass deportations. Would she deport their families, too? She shoved a thumbs up their way and said, "Yay!" Salon called the event the dumb Iowa steak fry, an omen for the horribly dull political year to come. MSNBC's Joe Scarborough said of the footage of Hillary flipping a steak with a forced grin, "Hillary Clinton's problem for people that know her and like her, like I know her and like her, she puts on that political hat, and then she's a robot." When I got back to Des Moines that night, I grabbed a seat at Centro at the end of a long table next to Hillary's faith advisor, a blubbery, histrionic man. We called him Hands Across America, HAA, because he'd traveled the country with us in 2008 after a sexual harassment allegation led to his temporary banishment from the Hillary campaign's Virginia headquarters. A young staffer said he planted a wet, unwanted kiss on her head. The staffer, like most campaign employees, had signed a non-disclosure agreement and was transferred to a different department. After that, HAA ran an outside group that supported Hillary's 2016 bid, using his position to regularly feel up several of the young women who worked for him in hopes of landing a job on the campaign. He would be frozen out of the official 2016 campaign team. HAA exhibited generally creepy behavior but seemed more pitiful and effeminate than threatening, which is why I tried to ignore his rubbing up and down my back at the steak fry as we posed for a selfie that I posted on Instagram as if we were old friends. I once had a meeting in D.C. with HAA and a family friend of Hillary's who had the porcelain smile and abundant black lashes of a daytime TV host. HAA rubbed his hands together and said in his southern drawl, "I just love my job. I get to be in a locked office with all y'all pretty young girls." Hillary would sometimes mention him on the campaign trail, referring to her preacher friend who sends me scripture and devotionals, sometimes mini sermons every day, always leaving out the small detail that everyone suspected he was a pervert. As I took my seat next to HAA, I tried to ignore this detail, too, because that's what political reporters do when we are in Iowa. We write identical stories and suck up to drunk, lecherous sources at Centro. HAA massaged my shoulder with one hand and drank a whiskey on the rocks with the other. I put a couple of the fried Brussels sprouts with ranch dressing on my plate and sat there without speaking, attempting to contort my face into the expression I thought an unbothered male reporter would make. The other reporters grilled HAA about when Hillary might declare and whether she would even have a primary opponent. He pretended, like everyone on the unofficial payroll then, that she hadn't made up her mind. "Now come on, y'all, give her the space to make up her mind. She wants to take her time. Do it right this time. I sent her a scripture this morning that said..." I felt his hand move down my back. "I'm not feeling great. I think I'm going to head back to the Marriott," I said, jumping up. "No, Ames, now come on. You just got here," HAA said, tugging on the arm of my blazer. I dug around in my backpack and pulled out all the cash I had, $11, and tossed it in the middle of the table. Chapter 11, The Last Good Day. Honolulu, December 2014. Carolyn couldn't get me combat pay, but she must have known I was about to crack because she agreed to put me on the cushiest assignment in journalism as a reward after a bruising year in Hillaryville, babysitting the Obamas on their annual Hawaiian vacation. By my third day at the Moana Surfrider Hotel in Honolulu, I had the timing down. I'd wake up at 4 a.m. in my corner room of the old side of the hotel overlooking Waikiki Beach and Diamond Head and check in with my editors in Washington. I'd file the first draft of the setup story with any anticipating news,
Example, POTUS's statement about the North Korean hack on Sony, his planned visit to a mess hall at the Marine Corps base, around 7 a.m. This is all Hawaiian Aleutian time. Then I'd head downstairs to find a spot on Waikiki Beach, close enough to where the waves broke so that the sound of the salt water drowned out passing tourists, but far enough from the shoreline that the late afternoon tide wouldn't sweep up my laptop and reporter's notebooks and Richard Ben Kramer's What It Takes, the 1,072-page tome on the 1988 election that I was determined to get through before the 2016 campaign started, even if it meant skipping the Gephardt chapters. There were only a couple weeks left of 2014. Almost a year had passed since Planet Hillary made me persona non grata, and even some of the posers were speaking to me again. 6 months had gone by since the D.C. confrontation, and nothing made Carolyn happier than strutting into the daily morning meeting with the Times' top editors and fighting to get my stories on the front page. I'd learned not to rely on the guys. I'd cultivated a variety of sources that ranged from one of Bill Clinton's kindergarten friends to a State Department official turned Wall Street executive. Sourcing up usually involved a friendly off-the-record breakfast. I stopped doing dinners after the Inside You incident. A morally ambiguous donor and former aide always insisted we meet at the King Cole Bar at the St. Regis in Midtown Manhattan, under the gilded parish mural of Merry Old King Cole, surrounded by his obsequious court of knights, musicians, and servants. I always wanted a shower after. The Times' new executive editor, Dean Baquet, gave me his full support, as Jill had. Dean is from New Orleans and wore black suits with red pocket squares and rimless glasses. He called me kiddo and loved to gossip about Little Rock and Juanita's, the Tex-Mex restaurant where he met sources when he was a Los Angeles Times reporter looking into Hillary's commodity trades. Because of his early stint in Arkansas, Dean, along with Carolyn, succeeded Jill and Howell Raines as the latest embodiment of the Clintons' theory that the Times had it out for them. The bad blood from Bathroom Gate never went away. I remembered something a journal editor told me after a lengthy correction was appended to one of my early stories. We are all forged in the crucible of our mistakes, both professionally and personally. That was true of me in the CGI bathroom story. I assumed it was true of Hillary, too, forged in the crucible of all the conflicts she'd endured and the mistakes she'd made, ready to confront another campaign as an older, wiser, better version of herself. Ever since Jill put me on the beat, I'd anticipated 2015, the year Hillary would be a formal candidate and I'd have an actual campaign to cover. But I also dreaded what was to come, the stress, the constant travel, the battles, both with the guys and inside the steel cage match. Until then, the Hillary story had been mostly mine, but soon it would be bigger than me, bigger than any of us. I couldn't postpone the inevitable. But by some stroke of luck and a lot of sucking up to Carolyn, I could ring in 2015 on Oahu, one of the last places on Earth to celebrate the new year. By 3 p.m. Hawaii Aleutian Standard Time, Washington had completely forgotten about me. They'd practically forgotten about POTUS. I'd send notes updating my editors on his movements as instructed. Presidential motorcade departed Kailua compound at 4 p.m., or POTUS is bowling with friends. But Obama's mundane vacation whereabouts hardly warranted a story. So I packed every indulgent afternoon with things I knew I wouldn't have time to do in the next 22 months until Election Day. I took surfing lessons. I discovered the frosé and sucked them down like $17 Slurpees. I tested out various shave ice options before settling on a little stand in a back alley behind a Thai massage parlor. I never wore makeup or anything other than flip-flops and left my watch in the hotel room because I didn't want a tan line. I didn't care what time it was anyway. Bobby came to visit for a few days with his golf clubs and SPF 50. On day 7, reinforcements arrived to help me with this arduous assignment. The Times' Mike Schmidt waddled onto the warm, carpeted sand of Waikiki, fully dressed and squinting. With a bulky black ThinkPad under one arm and his other hand cupped over his eyes looking out towards Diamond Head, he spoke loudly into an earpiece. No, it has to go tonight or we lose the exclusive. Had anyone else's restive D.C. ambition planted itself upon my 85-degree beach day, I would have been pissed off. But the sight of Schmitty made me smile. I waved for him to come sit, but he looked right past me. Yo, Schmidt, over here, I stood up. Hold on a sec, he said into the phone. I didn't recognize you. You look Latin. This didn't feel like an accomplishment, and the time that I'd worked on my tan and learned to stand up on a surfboard for a grand total of 15 seconds, Schmitty had already written a feature about Obama's mediocre golf skills, 14 handicap at best, and had broken a real talker on the presidential motorcade tapping inexperienced volunteer drivers to shuttle the press. He reemerged onto the beach in a swimsuit and was talking about how he needed to source, i.e. drink, with White House staffers who spent most of the Hawaii trip lounging around the pool, hoping not to have to partake in tropical beverages with some go-getter reporter in Panama Jacks. We were bad enough fully clothed. I loaned Schmidt the highest SPF I had and dragged him into the ocean. We didn't so much swim as wade in to where the water was so deep we couldn't touch and buoy around. A couple of uptight beat reporters dipped into the warm water. The surfers and catamarans on the horizon drew nearer, and my de facto beach office became a tiny sliver on the sand. I don't want to call it a baptism. That would be melodramatic, and if the two of us had anything besides scoring the winter White House gig in common, it was that we looked like old friends from Jewish summer camp. But the universe was trying to tell us something in the ocean that day. Schmitty calls it the last good day. I think of it as the afternoon of impending doom. Whatever you call it, we got back to the mainland, and before our tans had faded, an editor called me late one Thursday night to tell me that David Carr had collapsed and died in the newsroom. I dragged myself into the office the next morning, past the spot under the Times awning where David always smoked. I took the elevator to the second floor, walked to what had been David's corner cubicle, his piles of illegible notes scrawled on legal pads, the backside of press releases and the insides of file folders, his silly Minnesota knickknacks, donut crumbs sprinkled like a dusting of snow across his desk, that scarf strewn over the back of his chair. I sat on the floor by the trash can, pressed my back against the cold windows overlooking the Port Authority bus terminal, hugged my knees into my chest, and bawled. I tried to muffle this drooling, groveling fit into my gray sweatshirt. So many people lost David, his wife and three daughters, his siblings, his journalism students, his neighbors in Montclair, New Jersey, who knew him as the goofy suburban dad with the leaf blower, the millions of readers who relied on his steady, scathing voice to make sense of things. But for those 3 minutes, in a cubicle that still smelled of camels and cafeteria coffee, I let myself wallow in self-pity, sobbing to the spirit of David that I couldn't make it through the election without his all-knowingness, without our ramen lunches and his reminders that I deserved to be where I was, doing what I was doing. 2 weeks after that, Schmitty broke the story that Hillary exclusively used private email at the State Department. I soon found myself at the United Nations for the first, "What about your emails?" press conference, and everything took an irrevocable turn for the worse. Chapter 12. Email Ghazi. You swallowed everything, like distance, like the sea, like time. In you, everything sank. Pablo Neruda, The Song of Despair. United Nations, March 2015. The 2016 election started on the second floor of the United Nations in a tiny sliver of mid-century hallway. It had been 8 days since the initial Time story broke, and the hysteria over Hillary's email practices had only intensified. She'd sent out an 11:35 p.m. tweet that went through half a dozen revisions and tweaks from lawyers until everyone settled on, "I want the public to see my email. I asked State to release them. They said they will review them for release as soon as possible." The guys were dizzy counting retweets. 1,000 retweets already. "Good to know people go to bed with their Twitter decks. Sex must be obsolete," wrote John Podesta, the veteran White House aide who would serve as Hillary's campaign chairman. "I just spit out my Diet Coke onto my desk," Brown Loafers replied. "We're at 1,791. 6 days and nearly 8,000 retweets later, we got word that Hillary would be holding a brief press conference after addressing a Women's Empowerment Principles event at the UN. An email from the guys included details, for those of you that are not already coming, which included just about everyone.
The alert sent several hundred reporters, cameramen, producers, and photographers to storm the UN credential office. The office had the feel of a multicultural DMV with brown twill carpet, vintage desktop computers, and the words Media Accreditation printed on typing paper and stuck to the wall. A lone UN staffer seated behind a low desk tried to handle the deluge of requests to get inside, a process that typically takes weeks and requires background checks, social security numbers, passports, and recommendation letters. The guys emailed us all at 11:27 a.m. saying we had to reply by 11:45 a.m. to secure a spot. At the risk of revealing my complete lack of journalistic instinct, I'll admit that when Schmidt first told me about how Hillary had exclusively used ClintonMail.com, I thought it was another one of his killer scoops. But nothing earth-shattering, certainly not a nuclear winter, as a former National Archives official put it. I think I said, "Oh wow, cool story, thanks for the heads up." Even after seeing the reaction to that first story, I predicted the fever would lift in a week or so, that people would get tired of reading about the intricacies of the Federal Records Act, snooze, and move on. But the story only gained speed. I'd never been a part of anything like it. The standout scandals of 2008, Jeremiah Wright, Bristol Palin's teen pregnancy, mostly offended along ideological divides, storms that would eventually pass. But the private server was more like an avalanche, blind outrage that barreled through every newsroom and war room, devouring everything. All this came in the midst of Bobby and Mai finally concluding a 2-year apartment hunt, having settled on a co-op on the Lower East Side in a hulking red brick mid-century tower that still had a Shabbos elevator that stopped on every floor. Bobby had done all the paperwork to secure a more favorable mortgage. "Do you promise to be there? All you have to do is show up," he'd said the night before, organizing our tax returns and pay stubs and contracts I'd never seen before into a manila folder. "Yes, of course, I promise I'll be there." And I was there, sort of. As Fred from Citibank explained our fixed interest rates, I was also on a conference call with my editors, planning how we'd cover the UN press conference. I unmuted the call. "Yeah, I can file quick off the presser if Schmidt wants to take the lead," I said. Then I muted the line and turned back to Fred. "Yep, yep, that all sounds good. Where do I sign?" The next 30 years of my life was now tied to a mortgage payment that I paid almost no attention to, Hillary once again overshadowing a marital rite of passage. "Is there anything you care more about than Hillary? Anything? Jesus. And there's not even a campaign yet," Bobby said, as we walked out onto the street the morning of Hillary's UN presser. He handed me the manila envelope. "Do you think you could drop this in the mailbox? It has to go today. Could you maybe squeeze that in between Hillary since I've done everything else?" I grabbed the envelope. "Yes, yes, of course, I'm really sorry, but..." "I know, you have to go. Just don't forget to mail it." I tried to kiss him, but he gave me an icy cheek. I waved the envelope at him in a you-can-count-on-me motion. I watched his tangerine ski jacket, the one that he'd pulled from a discount rack and that every winter I tried to get him to replace with a sensible neutral color, disappear into the midtown crowds and rush to the Far East Side. I arrived at the UN press office hours after the rest of the horde and grabbed the first UN worker I saw to ask if I was in the right place. "I'm going to try to say this and not sound too sarcastic," she said in an upper-crust English accent. "But what about me makes you think that I care or know the answer to your question?" The day got worse from there. This wasn't the way Hillary wanted to start her second campaign, but there was a kind of cosmic alignment. I'd blown off a marital obligation to push my way into prototypical Clinton chaos at the UN, a bureaucratic, impenetrable organization, well-intentioned but ultimately out of step with the modern era. I waited with a delegation of Ethiopians in a security line that snaked around First Avenue. When we got through, a guard escorted us to the area known in UN parlance as the stakeout, where heads of state and special envoys talked to the diplomatic press in front of a bisque-colored wall with a UN Security Council muslin backdrop. To our right was a glowing red exit sign, and to the left were 15 flags of Security Council members so shoved together they resembled a tangle of tablecloths hanging at the dry cleaners. But the only visual we cared about was the almost life-size replica of Picasso's Guernica, looming behind the podium. The press couldn't pass up the symbolism, Hillary confronting the media against the backdrop of a carnal, bloody battle scene.
the mother of all advanced fuck-ups. I thought that painting was in fucking Madrid, one of the guys said. Hillary was at the UN to mark the upcoming 20th anniversary of her 1995 address on women's rights in Beijing. I was fascinated by Hillary's Beijing speech, both in what she said to the women's delegation, human rights are women's rights and women's rights are human rights, and in what the speech meant to her political formation. Hoping to put the failures of Hillary Care behind her and forge her own identity, Hillary, then 47, defied the West Wing and insisted she address the cavernous conference hall that hosted the UN Fourth World Conference on Women. Critics at the time called the speech part of the First Lady's radical feminist agenda and anti-family. But even then, her aides saw it. With the help of a savvy PR strategy back home, potentially becoming Hillary's I Have a Dream moment. She'd hardly left the State Department when she told her team she wanted to build on Beijing and make known, especially to women too young to remember, that she'd been at the feminist forefront. There were plans for a Hillary Beijing Bitmoji, an animated blonde with a Betty Draper bob and powder pink suit, and a press rollout around the anniversary. I had written a 1,500-word story that traced her career and upcoming presidential campaign back to Beijing. It never ran in print. The email story caused all Planet Hillary's competing concentric circles to combust. No one frothed at the mouth blaming the email controversy on a voracious and irresponsible news media more than the raging Cajun. James Carville's bald head and jutted jaw quickly blanketed the cable airwaves. "Y'all are just gonna go out there and say she raised more questions than she answered," Carville told MSNBC. Then, in the least helpful defense I heard, Carville reminded viewers of the laundry list of previous Clinton scandals. "Do you remember Whitewater? Do you remember Filegate? You remember Travelgate? You remember Pardongate? You remember Benghazi?" "We do now, James." Mandy Grunwald, the mysterious media consultant long immortalized in Clinton lore dating back to 1992, suggested Hillary do a sit-down interview with someone friendly, Robin Roberts maybe. Hillary could explain that she'd done it for convenience, and a lot of emails were about Chelsea's wedding and yoga and planning her mother Dorothy Rodham's funeral. It would all be so relatable. The newcomers, Jim Margolis, the recently hired ad man, and the pollster, Joel Benenson, both Obama campaign veterans, argued that Hillary should do a handful of interviews with the Times and the Post, serious outlets that most people wouldn't accuse of being too cozy. Hillary hated this idea. In the end, she went with what she knew, the 1990s. "They won't stop until I do it," she'd said. Confronting the hysteria head-on with a traditional press conference had worked wonders in 1994 when Hillary sat in a rose-colored sweater set for 68 minutes, deftly parrying an onslaught of questions about her and Bill's investments in Arkansas. In response to a question about why she and the president hadn't handled Whitewater differently, Hillary said, "Well, shoulda, coulda, woulda, we didn't." She was cutting and sarcastic and funny. The Washington Post said the First Lady sounded confident and unflappable, and that the casual setting conveyed an openness and eagerness to engage in a full give and take. The press spent a couple hours waiting for Hillary, crammed into the stakeout like pigs in a trough. By this point, I'd let Bobby down, possibly signed my life over to Fred from Citibank, and been belittled by a UN worker. I didn't have a lot of dignity left. I begged the official UN videographer to let me stand behind him if I promised not to move while straddling one of the legs of his tripod. I separately swore to a nearby German photographer who'd been there for 3 hours that I wouldn't stand all the way up and block his shot. One stray move and we would have had a diplomatic incident. It was in this uncomfortable scrum that the makings of Hillary's 2016 traveling press corps took shape. The travelers included reporters for all the major wire services, the Associated Press, Reuters, Bloomberg, the newspapers that could still afford to splurge on travel, the Washington Post, the Times, the Wall Street Journal, the new media disruptors, Politico, BuzzFeed, and embeds, the 20-somethings from all the major TV networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, Fox News, who embed themselves with their assigned candidates. That day I found myself shoulder to shoulder with the AP's Ken Thomas, who wrote upside down as he held his notebook flat against his thighs because there wasn't any space to hold the 3-inch pad upright. To my right were Jennifer Epstein, a.k.a. Jen Epps of Bloomberg News, and Annie Carney of Politico, both shoved in so tight that their feet practically lifted off the carpet.
Finally, at 2:59 p.m., when the stakeout had become a stew of body odor and the German's cologne, Hillary walked to the lectern, opened a black binder, and after addressing women's rights and negotiations over the Iran deal, spoke slowly about her emails. She lifted her eyebrows and with every other sentence looked up from her prepared remarks, assembled hurriedly by her team of aides and lawyers, including David Kendall and her old friend and speechwriter Jim Kennedy. I opted for convenience to use my personal email account, which was allowed by the State Department because I thought it would be easier to carry just one device for my work and for my personal emails instead of two, Hillary said. She spoke deliberately, explained she hadn't broken the law in using the email account, worked in her yoga routines, wedding planning, her mother's funeral arrangements, you know, all the other things you typically find in inboxes. She explained that she chose not to keep those private emails. No one wants their personal emails made public, and I think most people understand that and respect that privacy. She didn't use the D word, but all we heard in chose not to keep was deleted. Hillary called on me third after a Turkish reporter, per UN protocol, who would prompt ridicule and rumors about planted question when he innocently asked, "If you were a man today, would all this fuss be made?" MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell, per everything, got the second question. Then Hillary pointed toward me. "Hi, right there." For the only time during the press conference, she grinned and in an almost maternal motion batted her hand to quiet the shouts from CBS News and Al Jazeera. "She's sort of squashed, so we've got to," Hillary said. "Hi, Secretary," I said, still crouched down to avoid the German cameraman's wrath. Ken and I had rehearsed our questions, but I still spoke too fast, running my two-part question together. "I was wondering if you think you made a mistake in either exclusively using your private email or in the response to the controversy around it, and if so, what have you learned from that?" "Well, I have to tell you that, as I said in my remarks, looking back, it would have probably been, you know, smarter to have two devices." Hillary could have acknowledged it was a mistake and apologized. But even as I joined the delirium of the scrum, I understood her instinct. She thought using a private email was another non-story, the biggest nothing burger, started by the Times and amplified by her political rivals. Every elected official, even Obama, aides said, off the record, used a personal email. Why should she apologize? One of Trump's close associates told me Trump had been baffled watching the spectacle unfold on CNN. It was one of the first times he knew that if he ran, he could beat her. Trump said he would have ended the first press conference with an emphatic, "I'm done talking about this." I sometimes wonder whether Hillary would have seemed more genuine if she'd adopted Trump's tactics. If she'd come out at the stakeout alongside a lawyer, female, 50-something, attractive but not too attractive, and stacks of documents and manila folders displayed like props as Trump did at one of his more theatrical press conferences. Should she have ditched the legalese and given us the real reason she used a private server? "Of course I didn't want the dishonest media reading through my emails. Look at what they've put me through for 25 years. That makes me smart." Could Hillary have told my profession what she really thought of us and dismissed the email story altogether as more fake news from the failing New York Times? Well, shoulda, coulda, woulda, she didn't. There were no taxis, so I got on a crosstown bus back to the newsroom, my laptop and MiFi balanced on my lap, my stomach growling. I typed the first draft of the first, "What about your emails?" story. Schmidt would add his reporting to my coverage of the press conference. Carolyn would give it a read, followed by the copy desk, who scanned it for factual and grammatical errors. The slot would take a look and defy every fiber of a newspaper editor's old-school being by popping it on the homepage as soon as possible. As the afternoon progressed, Schmidt and I would perfect the story, adding insights, fact-checking statements Hillary made, and making adjustments that very senior editors requested until the final version for the historical printed record on page one, above the fold, was as close to flawless as possible for a story that started on the M42 crosstown bus. Dateline, United Nations. Hillary Rodham Clinton revealed on Tuesday that she had deleted about half her emails from her years as Secretary of State. James Carville called it. The Guernica press conference only raised more questions than it answered. We stayed in the newsroom all night, studying up on government rules, talking to sources about whether Hillary would postpone her campaign announcement, scheming with Carolyn about the next day's story and the story for the day after that, and the fifth day story that could anchor the all-important Sunday Times. Hillary would later say the Times covered the email story like it was Pearl Harbor. She was right. Ever since that first news conference, there was an insatiable appetite for email-related stories. I can't explain it exactly, except to compare it to a fever that spread through every newsroom and made us all salivate over the tiniest morsels. Cable news talkers talked, readers clicked, click, clicked, Republicans feasted. All of this heightened the fever until reporting on Hillary's emails, asking Hillary about her emails, poring over 30,000 pages of Hillary's emails. She got stood up for a cabinet meeting. She can't work a fax machine. She loves upstate apples. Became an almost out-of-body impulse, turning us all into whirlpools set on the rinse and repeat cycle. I never agreed with Hillary that her email server was a non-story, especially after the FBI opened its investigation. But I would regret, and even resent, that it became the only story. But that was months later, when the emails swallowed everything. In those early days, I felt invigorated and grateful to be so central in covering such a monster news event. I wanted to prove I was worthy to myself, to my editors, to the guys. I wanted to keep the polar bear alive. I left the newsroom after 2 a.m., still high from closing our page one story and from Hillary calling me squashed on national television. Too antsy to take a taxi, I climbed down the subway stairs at Times Square and dug around in my backpack for my Metro card. That's when I felt the manila envelope. Chapter 13. What Makes You So Special? April 2015. I couldn't sleep the night before the announcement. Bobby was visiting his family in Ireland. I wouldn't have blamed him for giving me the Hillary or me ultimatum after the mortgage fiasco. I lay in bed, stretching a leg over to his empty side of the mattress, wondering how many times I'd let him down over the next 19 months, how much he'd put up with. Not long after the email server story first broke, I made a 24-hour trip to Miami for the sole purpose of shouting a, "What about her emails?" question at Bill Clinton as he wandered around a Liberty City housing project helping underprivileged kids during a Clinton Foundation day of action. I am not proud of this. Bill wore blue jeans and a baby blue t-shirt that hugged his paunch. He looked like he'd wandered away from a game of Mahjong at a senior center. "I have an opinion, but I have a bias," he said when CNN asked if his wife had been treated fairly in the private server brouhaha. I pressed again. He took a step towards me. Then he stopped himself. "I shouldn't be making news on that." Later, Clinton pulled me aside next to a bouncy castle and introduced me to a Peruvian farmer who'd relocated to eastern Arkansas. "Amy, Amy, come over here. Here's a story you ought to be doing." The guys were always trying to get me to cover the day of action, but for some reason, they weren't thrilled that I made the trip down that day. "I don't care what you write because no one takes you seriously," outsider guy told me. I couldn't get that line out of my head. It hurt even more that it had come from him. "No one takes you seriously." I lay in bed studying a stack of Time stories I'd printed out to see how my esteemed predecessors had covered previous presidential announcements. Robin Toner, 1991. "Governor Bill Clinton of Arkansas entered the race for the Democratic presidential nomination today with an unstinting indictment of a decade of Republican domestic policies and a promise to restore the American dream for the forgotten middle class." The forgotten middle class had such lyricism and aplomb, a single evocative expression dreamed up by a centrist think tank with a similar sentiment to make America great again, minus the kitschy overreach and racist undertones. I wanted to write a sweeping lead when Hillary started her campaign. The Brooklyn campaign headquarters had invited the Hillary press corps to an off-the-record spaghetti dinner at John Podesta's house in D.C. The goal, in addition to trying to signal newly improved relations with the press, had been setting expectations for the announcement and launch period and framing the HRC message and framing the race. Podesta, Hillary's campaign chairman and a White House chief of staff to Bill Clinton and counselor to Obama, had a skeletal, hyper-disciplined frame, a distance runner swallowed by a gray suit. He exuded the cool calm and steely on-message detachment needed to wrangle the throngs of friends, donors, and advisors that chased after Hillary. He'd known Hillary since the McGovern campaign in 1972, and although she wasn't as enamored with him as Bill was, they did share some endearing quirks. Podesta believed in UFOs and encouraged Hillary, also a believer and an X-Files fan, to promise during the campaign to open the files on Area 51.